Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Gary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Gary.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in his own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one shall consider these self-revealing accounts to be in bad taste. Our hope is that many an alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I have one of them. I, too, must have this thing. I'm delighted to be able to introduce a fellow who we met through a mutual friend. The mutual friend has since gone off, and we don't see a whole lot of him anymore, but the friendship that I have with this gentleman continues to grow, and also he is a gentleman who is half of a delightful couple that meets regularly at the Solution Group. And if you haven't seen them in action, please go to that meeting and do so. I give you Steve.
Hey everybody, I'm Steve R. I'm an alcoholic.
It's good to be here.
Excuse me. First time I ever came to this room, it was Maggie Harrison down at Biscayne. Says, Steve Riddell, they're having a dance and a dinner at NABA, and I want you to go over there and stand by the garbage can and take everybody's plate and say thank you. You're not allowed to eat, and you're not allowed to dance. So that's how bad off I was. I'm going to do, for the first time in my life, I'm going to put it in a general way, what things were like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And you got to understand that I can say at this phase of my development, because the further I move away from a drink and the closer I move to my creator, they'll use the word creator in there. My creator, things get a little bit less skewed, if there is such a thing. It's pretty neat because I got a guy in the room that took me through the steps, and I asked him to come here because he knows the truth about me, and that may be a chance for me helping y'all. So before I came here, I didn't pray much, but I'm going to pray now because I've got a lot of evidence in my life of the power of prayer and how well it works. God, give me peace, show me the truth, and please direct my thinking. Speak through me that I might help someone else. Amen. You know, I'm a native Atlantan. I haven't always lived here. I was born out on a dirt road in between Doraville and Chandler. I got two siblings. I have a brother who's 8 years older than me, a brother 5 years older than me, who died last year of cancer. I asked him to, never mind, that's not good, to smoke one for me on the way out, because I used to be addicted to that too. And, you know, we came up in a household where I had a mom who sheltered me. She sheltered me from all the dysfunction in our home. And my brothers, naturally, through the progression of their marriage, they didn't have it as good as I did when they came through. But then Dad had done some things with his life, and I had it pretty easy. And I see my brother today. He's 8 years older than me. He's a gentleman. He's a spiritual man. And we have conversations about our household, and he says, you know, you're not realistic. You know, he says, You say nice things about our dad, and you say all these nice things about the house we grew up in. He says, our house was classic textbook child abuse. And so, you know, I never felt okay about myself. I had a dad who was a do-as-I-say-do, not do-as-I-do kind of guy. And he didn't mind flogging me if I didn't look at him right. But he, you know, he was a guy. He was a jovial fellow, and see, that's the thing. And I have all his good traits, and I have all his bad traits. And I don't get much mileage out of the bad So I try to apply the good ones. I have to give him the benefit of being human and being fallible. And, you know, when I used to try to figure out what was going on with them. That was their relationship. I see a lot of people who try to, what was going on with my folks? It's none of my business, you know. I'll try to say nice things to my brother about my mom, and he'll go, she couldn't have been too smart. She married our dad. So the neat thing is I'll tell you this. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned that we need not be a glum lot, and there's a lot of joy about it all. And I never know what I'm going to say when I'm up here. Sometimes I channel Gallagher or George Carlin or Billy Graham or something. I've had a lot of different things happen in my life. My mom was trying to lead me to the light. My dad, he was his liquor worked for him. He was a jovial guy, like I say. He was in the restaurant equipment business, and he met a lot of different kind of people, and he would install equipment and drag us all over town. He usually got free food and free booze everywhere because he was in that business. And so he strayed away from the house, and his liquor stopped working for him fast, probably in his mid-30s, mid-40s. And I was born when he was in his 30s. And so, you know, it was my mom, she had to put up with a lot of crap from my dad. I mean, he was drinking up the profits, and he wasn't keeping his vows. And so, you know, I experienced a lot of that stuff in that household. And when I first got here, my perceptions have changed a lot. When I first got here, I was one who would tell you, my mom drugged me to church, made me go, and shoved her religion down my throat. Well, in sobriety, with a higher power who works powerfully in my life, now I'm going to tell you, I'm glad she loved me enough to take me to church and give me the opportunity to make my own choice whether or not I really wanted to study Scripture and worship with other people in the church. You know, I got away from all that stuff. And you know, I was in, the only thing I never felt part of anything. I had these big ears. And my mom dressed me funny, pretty stylishly, you know. And all my friends were wearing blue jeans, and I had all these colored stuff. A lot of it she sewed. And I was a mama's boy, I'm here to tell you. You know, and it's okay because, you know, I was born, I was 2 months premature, 7 months. So we'd like to think that my brain didn't finish getting formed around the house. And I still, that's part of the problem. But part of my problem is my thinking now that I don't drink. But I've received a reprieve from that. And it's interesting because I never thought I was ever going to be okay, and I never felt okay. I mean, from when I first went, I can remember, there's two things in this life the very spiritual man's taught me. There's only two feelings, and there's love and fear. And I can look back, and I can remember the first time I was afraid. My brothers would not let me go with them, and I was only about this big. And I started trying to follow them, and I got stuck, like Tim Conway. You know, I got stuck in the mud in a diaper. And I can remember moving around saying, you guys are not going to include me. What is this? You're not including me. So that's the first time I didn't feel part of. Okay. Then I go to school my first day of first grade. And they tell me about it. I remember that I had two hands and 2 feet in the door screaming, I'm not going to go. And they had to push me in there. I never got along. I never got along with people. I never felt good about myself. And we do a lot of things. There's some things in our defect character. The phoniness and the fake. I've found that it's unnatural things that we do to make people, to draw people to us, actually repulse them all the more. You know, so I was doing a lot of things all along the way to try to say, hey, won't you accept me? Won't you be my friend? And I never learned to be true to myself, which they hid that on my chip, by the way. It took me a few years to find that. I didn't know how to be true to myself. In an effort to make me, pull me out of that, my mom tried involving me in Scouts. She tried involving me in church choir. We came along, and she got to this point where she was tired of my dad's drinking. She was tired of his womanizing. She caught him at it, and he didn't, you know, he wasn't trying to hide it, doesn't seem like, you know, he didn't care, seemed like. And I don't really know because I never had a chance to ask him about it, but I never really cried about this. I might cry. That'd be cool. It cleanses your soul. When I was 15, when I was 15, I was on a choir tour one summer. I really had a good time at church. I really had a good time. I really enjoyed going there. I enjoyed being with those young people. I enjoyed the Bible, and I enjoyed singing in a choir. That's what drew me there mostly. And we had a great choir director in Sandy Springs at the First Baptist Church. And I got to go on a choir tour. And we sang with Billy Graham a couple of summers. And, you know, that was kind of cool. You know, I felt like, hey, you know, this might be the thing I want to do with myself. So that second summer, I came home, and we went on vacation. And all our family had a bunch of places down at the little lagoon in Gulf Shores. So we went down there, and I was pretty good on water skis even there. And my mom was too, and I used to take the short road. Well, we went skiing August 10th, 1969, and I was on the short road. I was having a good time ducking, and all of a sudden, we came into the house, and we decided to go crabbing down at Fort Morgan at the end. We're out there, Mom's having a good time. We're double-handed and pulling in a bunch of crabs, and Mom keels over and has a cerebral hemorrhage. And things kind of changed. I came back from my vacation without Mom. And so immediately we got back to the house, and my dad had lost his lover and his best friend. And, you know, he, like me, was one of those guys with women. Won't you take care of me while I run your life? So he didn't know a whole lot of what to do about me. I was a problem to him. I interfered with his drinking. He was fairly successful in business, and he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to raise a kid. My mom was the nurturer. So he pretty much said, live in my house my way or get the hell out. And at the same time, he went and married a woman. I don't know that he was in love with her, but he wanted to bring a woman into the house who could maybe take on the burden of me, get me directed, get me through school. And it didn't work out. Well, that first weekend when we came home, I'm going to say that I need to qualify myself as an alcoholic. I'm bouncing around. I've got untreated adult ADHD. And sometimes I have immediate negative retention. What did I just say? So it's a case that, you know, there's a lot of things that happened along the way. And I don't need to dwell on those. I guess a good AA speak is, don't stay drunk too long. Get to God fast. And then tell what this program means to me. It's everything in my life. But it's not normal to go to Boy Scout camp at Bird Adams and put Falstaff and Playboys in your haversack. And I did that, and they sent me home. I'm not going to go in too much of a drunk law. I think that qualifies me. Okay? So then we went to Lake Burton to the cabin one time and took the kids from choir up there. And I took them in the woods and tried to mix some martinis. So that was the next time that we saw that maybe I might have some problems. And they didn't know what to do. And so after Mom died, and none of the efforts she was making to try to groom me to fit into society and learn, there never was any compromise for me. There never was any, it was all me. I was a taker. And I, the only reason I was ever in a friendship or a relationship with anybody is to get what I could get out of it. And I was very selfish and self-centered. And so, somewhere along the way, my dad used to, the child abuse part, he would take me to the drive-in with him. He'd get soccer, and I'd sit in the back seat. He thought I was sleeping. He took me to see Robert Mitchum. Some of y'all don't know about him. He's way before your time. But he took me to see Robert Mitchum in Thunder Road. Well, this guy was slick, and he sold whiskey, and he was a sneaky guy and a devious guy. And about that same couple of years, I saw Paul Newman in Hood, and I wanted to be that kind of renegade. So after my dad married that lady to try to make a home for me, I was 15 years old. We weren't getting along. And he goes, I don't know what to do about you. So they had some ladies from the church tried to help me out, ladies who sang in choir with my mom and worshiped with my mom. So they took me from Chamblee, and we moved to Sandy Springs, and they moved me into one of their homes. And I was doing pretty good for about a year and a half. You know, that's a pretty traumatic thing for a 15-year-old, but what I'm going to say is that's part of life. Life's taught me now that's just part of life. You know, you got to go on. I got a friend of mine who now today has had much more tragedy in her life than me, and she calls it a new normal. So, you know, now that's the way things happen to me now. I have a lot of new normals, and that was my new normal that I wasn't willing to accept. So when I didn't get along in that house, I wasn't willing to live his way. He handed me $100 a week allowance. This is in 1970. This should take care of your dry cleaning. You can eat out if you want to. And he checked me into the Howard Johnson Hotel on Roswell Road. I was the only kid that had a brand new car with the keys with no driver's license and was driving to school every day and had $100 to burn. And this is alcohol, and I've never talked about anything outside of the singleness of purpose, but I hate that word. You know, I fell in with a really bad crowd and became an entrepreneur. And it was pretty easy to do when you're funded by dad. So all of a sudden, here I go from this little DeKalb County school out in the woods. I'm over in Sandy Springs, and it's a little bit faster pace for me now. And we found out I was in the North Springs area, so we moved up there. I didn't get along. I didn't get along in school. I drank heavy. My granddad had died and left me a big box full of family trinkets, and what I wanted was his flask. So I got his flask, and I filled it up, and I carried it with me all the time. I watched my dad, who kept the booze in the kitchen cabinet, one in his briefcase, one in his glove box, and one in his desk for work. I started drinking like that. And all my friends' parents, they didn't like to see me coming because none of them had cars, and I did. And I had a job, and I was making my own money, and it wasn't good. I wouldn't get along with the school. So my brother saw that I was going to end up getting killed. And so at age 17, he says, you know, you're going to die running with this crowd. And he says, I don't think this is what our parents wanted for you. He goes, I'm really afraid. So he got my guardianship. He had come back from Vietnam, and he got my guardianship. Son of a God. He used to make me do push-ups for making C's. But that's my big brother, right? So anyhow, it didn't work out. He had a new wife and a new baby, and they didn't need me in their home. I was a problem for them as well. So my brother decided, since he'd been in the military, he'd been in military school, and he had been received that type of discipline. He says, your problem is you have no discipline. What we need to get you is some discipline. So we went down to the AFES down in Atlanta. And they turned me down because I had been born, I had rheumatic fever when I was born and I had a heart murmur. And I had some problems. And they said, well, 4-H, we're not going to take you. So he goes, oh, hell, what are we going to do now? Well, he devises this plan. We'll go to Opelika, Alabama, which in 1970, all they had there was a flagpole, a McDonald's, a post office, and an Air Force recruiter who had never signed but maybe one or two people in his life. So I helped him make his quota. And they signed me up. And they sent me to Lackland Air Force Base. And that was a mess. I get in there, you know, and I showed a little bit of bearing, military bearing. So they made me a squad leader. I had to keep my stuff and 17 people, other people. This is a guy with no discipline. And somewhere I got to about 10 or 12 days. You got to make 30 days. That's not counting weekends. I got to 30 days, and some guy made me mad. He got us some gigs where we had to go do some running with packs on our back. And I said, son of a gun, I'm going to kill you. The DI heard it, and they sent me back. They put me in a different flight, and I wasn't a squad leader. I started over at day one. So the next one was I was getting a chip on my shoulder, and I was needing a drink. And I went into a in there, and I was withdrawing heavy from heavy drugs and alcohol when I went into basic. And so I was really having a tough time. They put me in that second room. I got up to 17 days. I'm going to get out one of these days. And what happens? I walked across the little red fire line and flipped a cigarette butt, and the DI saw me. Here I am, the guy that has a problem with authority that doesn't know how to follow rules. They sent me back. They didn't send me back. They put me in motivation. Well, this is a place where you got to, everywhere you go, you run. In the chow hall, you've got a fork in this hand and a knife in this hand. Roast beef, sir. Mashed potatoes, sir. And, you know, my first lesson, I used to wake up in the middle of the night going, mashed potatoes, sir. So, God, it was a traumatic thing. I even had to run in place in the shower. Well, somehow, it came down to the, I made it to 28 days, and they said, they called me before a board panel, and they said, Mr. Riddell, Airman Riddell, we're going to throw you in the brig because we're going to charge you with fraudulent enlistment because they found out about my record with the Army. I got on my knees and I begged them. I said, you know, I got really bad problems. I got some medical problems that I was counting on this insurance, and I said I was counting on being here because I got really, really no place to go, and I'm going to die. And I cried and I begged and I prayed, and they let me stay. And so they sent me to Minot, North Dakota, on the job training. And because I had grown up in my dad's restaurant equipment business, I knew how to pipe things, and I knew about burners and pilots and everything to do with furnaces, stoves, and anything gas fired. So they sent me on the job training to this place, 91st Civil Engineering School. Well, the first day I was supposed to go to base orientation, there was a guy hanging around the barracks. He glued stripes on my shirt, and I went to the NCO club. So I didn't learn about the base. And I stayed in there 3 months, 3 years, 8 months, and 12 days, and I somehow got out honorably. You know, and I came out, I started seeing a young lady that I'd known in high school, and it was a tragedy. We were both the last of three kids in both families. We both were spoiled rotten. We both were addicted to a lot of stuff and each other, and it just, you know, it didn't work out after 2 years, thank God. We got divorced, but along the way I'd gotten in the printing industry, and I'd grown up a little bit, and I found a way to make some pretty decent money. But the deal is, I spent it all on booze. And, I tried the geography. I tried going to Dallas, Texas for 5 or 6 years, and it was really, really bad. I mean, I could go on and on and on about how drunk and how stupid. I can out stupid each and every one of y'all, and I'm going to tell you that. But you know, I would invariably, when I got back to Atlanta, I would get drunk a lot. I blacked out every time I drank, and I got thrown in jail every time I drank, and that was like 3 times a week probably. I got taken down. I had to bail myself out and then get to work the next day. I'd lose my car all over Buckhead, and it was really bad. I'd lose my car, and it was just a tragedy. I never had anything in my life to lose because I never accomplished anything in my life. And that's through about age 33. I went before Judge Woodrow Tucker in Fulton County for about the, I think it was 32nd time in a 7-year period. And he said, this is it. He goes, I'm going to sentence you to 3 AA meetings a year for 3 years. So, you know, my sobriety date is May 31st, 1998. This was 9 years previous to that. I went to AA and I went out here to Biscayne, and they had this on the wall, same steps, and it meant a lot to me. And those guys took me under their wings, and they loved me. And I did the AA waltz, the 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and never fully did a good fourth step. I went right back out the door. But in that 5 years I was in AA, I'd met a girl 2 years before I got sober, and we had a child, and we weren't married. And I got sober, and I finally realized maybe I needed to marry his mom, and maybe I needed to try to make a home for him. And AA came fast for me, a lot of rapid changes as a result of doing the next right thing. Non-coincidental occurrences is the result of doing the next right thing. They were nothing more than miracles of this program and God. And God prospered me in a big way. I became productive. I developed some of the talent, God-given talents. And, I had a good life going there. But still, I didn't do a good fourth step. And that'll take you out every time. And I failed to enlarge my spiritual condition. I stopped praying. I stopped doing all the things that got me there. And at 5 years sober, I went back out. And I didn't have a slip. I made a conscious choice to go drinking. And I stayed out there for 3 years. And I got really, really good and sick. And all the things that God had given me in that time, the wife, the house, I racked up some money in the bank. I developed some disciplines, financial disciplines. Started taking care of myself. I made a choice to go join a church. And my life increased. And when I went back out, I lost my mind. I was divorced. I'd lost... I could see my son every other Saturday, 1 hour supervised. I owed a lot of money to the IRS. I'd gone deep in debt, too. I was living way above my means. And I've been out there about 3 years, and it got really, really bad. And the marriage that I had for about 12 years to that woman, it was 9 years to that woman. It went south, and we got divorced, and wrecked my kid's life, and lost my mind. And I came back into AA. I went to the Gwinnett room, and I walked in there, and I took my seat. My butt was whipped, and the thing about it, I'd never gotten a DUI. I wish I had. I wish I'd been caught sooner. I wish I'd been handed consequences sooner. I might have found out something about this and what was wrong with me. I just didn't know what was wrong with me. Well, it's kind of neat because there's a lot of people there. I got a good sponsor. I got a guy that was with me in the first meeting I was ever in that first time. He and I had formed a bond, and he agreed to sponsor me. I remember my first year, my first chip, he says, "Damn, I had to get a new phone plan this year because of you." And but the guy... I got into a place where Gary was talking about. There was some people with long-term sobriety. There was that fellow, and there was a lady, Margie. She had been friends with Lois, and she just had a lot of sobriety. And I went around. I learned to hang out with people with a lot of sobriety. I learned to go to literature studies. My first year, I had nowhere to go and nothing to do and nothing to be. I was insane. And I went to 3 meetings a day for my first year, 2 meetings a day for my second year. I immersed myself in this program. I had a guy walk up to me and go, "You know, if you don't have a home group, you're just hanging around. You need to get in a home group." And so he made me do a look. The same guy. I learned a thing where the person that said the thing I could relate to the most, I went and I got to know that person in every meeting. The person who was hurting the most, I went to that person and tried to maybe encourage them some way. And I found this program to show me I'm no further away from a drink than any of you. I'm not going to get any of you sober. Hopefully I don't get any of you drunk. And and the news is, all those things that were in these books, I got to say, these are props. This is how hard it was for me to get sober. I wore out a couple of books, and I used them. Now I got some sober books. And I had a guy tell me, you don't know anything about English. You don't know anything about our language. You need to get a couple of dictionaries. And every one of these words that he's italicized, and every word you don't understand in this literature, you go and you look it up. And I've done that. I still do it. And the reason I come to meetings today is to find out what happens to people who don't go to meetings. But yeah, we had a close-knit home group, and I was in that home group for 17 years, and somebody volunteered. It's not about me. I'm not a giver, but somebody raised my hand to be PICPC, and about the time I figured that out, I rotated out. So then they nudged me into treasurer, and God, I'm watching their money now. But I learned about prudent reserve, and I learned how to take care of my money, and I developed financial discipline doing that. But in doing that, I got to be GSR, and I got to go see how AA works. I saw There's a guy named Lowell. He's a pretty neat guy. He's been sober a long, long time. And he's an old hippie that retired from 30-some-odd years at General Motors. He was sitting up there in the very front of the room at the State Assembly with a three-piece suit and hair to hair. But he was conducting the business of AA. And there were just a lot of different people who told me they had come from a lot of different walks of life, but that they owed a lot to this program for the life that they'd been granted. And for me, it was way out of my reach. You know, I couldn't get past step two because I didn't think I'd ever been sane or could ever be sane again. You know, and it's interesting because I didn't think I would ever have any spiritual principles. And maybe some days I'm not. Some people say nice things, and I failed to believe it. I think, you know, the thing about us being egomaniacs with inferiority complex, there's a lot to that, you know. And it takes a long time for this program to work. It did, at least for me, because I found I was belligerent. I was in denial. And going through these steps and letting this process work on me, all those things that I denied about myself, as soon as I was able to share them with y'all, confess them to my higher power, and then take some action against them, I wasn't able to get rid of any of them. It took me a while to see that part where it said, humbly ask God to remove them, you know, and it took me a lot of years to do that, you know, and most of mine, because I am defiant, most of those things he delivered me from. And I just know I didn't want to get any mileage out of it, and I just don't do it as much anymore. But it's kind of interesting because in this program, I've grown up in AA. I've been thinking about it the last couple of days, not thinking of what I might say here or to help anybody, but I've been thinking about the men and women who helped me get sober. And I've had a few of them die drunk, but I've had a great number of them die sober. Some of them say things like, heck with cancer, I'm dying sober, you know. And there's been about three this year, and I go to the celebration of their life, and there's not a tear in the room, and there's a lot of joy involved. And I look and I think about those guys, and I go, they left a legacy of love, and I'm not so sure I'm going to be doing that yet, so I need to get busy. And I found that, you know, for me, I found I can't stay busy. I can't stay sober on yesterday's work. I've had some things that happened to me with my health and over the last couple of years, and I wasn't as busy as I'd like to stay, and I've had this new rejuvenation. But I'm going to tell you, the world opened up to me when I was able to make the amends and get me out from under the guilt and the remorse. Some guys told me guilt's just a big waste of time. It's just another effort for you to try to gain recognition. Everything that I ever did, I volunteered for. I used to think it was a dog-eat-dog world and everybody was out to get me. And this program showed me it's a very spiritual place if I choose to participate. So, you know, somewhere in there, we're people of extremes. I just wanted to be normal, but that's the place I pass through as I go from one extreme to the other. And so I came in here. I had betrayed my wife. I had a girlfriend half my age, and I owed a lot of money, and I was just a real buffoon. And this program changed a lot of things about me. And, you know, I found a pathway to freedom in we agnostics. It's important in this literature that we look at the italicized places. We look for capitalizations that come out of nowhere in the middle of sentences. And, you know, over the years, the things I never thought I could ever comprehend, whenever I would get in fear, and even now today when I get in fear, a lady showed me this prayer. It was, give me peace, show me the truth, and direct my thinking. And the minute I do that, you know, these defects of character, he uses in the literature, he calls them sins, if you will, in this volume. And so doubt really is a big waste of time. It's a big defect. I can't subscribe to this program and doubt it at the same time. I've got to trust the process, and I've got to walk through it. And I'm going to tell you that, you know, there's only a few things I need to know. That I'm an alcoholic, you know, and it's important that I reach a bottom. it's important that all those yes, you eventually too can occur for me. I have a failure to form a bond with another human being. I did that with my sponsor. And he showed me how to love myself. And I duplicated that with others. You know? And he told me to pay it forward. He said he wasn't going to lead me anywhere. And he didn't want me to follow him. He was willing to walk beside me as we took this convoluted mess and made something out of it. And this happened for me. I have a problem with authority. I don't like to be told what to do before I came to this program. Now, it's really weird. It comes out of my mouth a lot of times, like in the bank, in different places. I go, the rules are here to protect me. Where the hell did that come from? But it's true. You know, I've got to subordinate myself to a lot of things that I don't necessarily agree with. And this program has given me a lot of freedom now. You know, I'm not mad. I'm not afraid. I've got no one, maybe a couple of people, sure. I'm very difficult. I've learned this year. I'm very difficult to be around. The old program said, shut up for now. Get away from the podium. We got to go home tonight. But, you know, it's interesting because that thing I had a problem with relationships, business and platonic and with females. And when I decided not to date. I ended up getting custody of my son. I ended up getting him through high school. And the same lady that taught me that prayer about showing me the truth, facts, truth, reality work. My perceptions don't work. She also said, Steve, it's important that you want what you have. And I want what I have these days. I went out and I learned to love myself. I learned to relate to God. I became the kind of person I'd like to be around. I started ending my prayers with, if it be pleasing to you. Instead of firing off these prayers hoping I would hit something, I found out that God's listening to y'all as well as me, and I need to make it fast and not waste his time. I put a lot of pleases and a lot of thank yous in between all those gimmies, and I don't waste his time. I used to pray for things that weren't good for me. I pray for things that he approves of these days, and I got a lot, you know. I got a lot in my life. It's important that I keep a job and a home group. It's important that I honor those meetings that I go to. It's important that I pick up some more meetings because when I go there, I find some newcomers. They teach me what I need to know. And I can be participating in their lives while they construct and reach God's potential for them. So, you know, it's interesting because I say, God, help me to recognize and receive that one you have for me. And this woman that I never even thought about before, I walked up to her at the coffee pot and said, you know, you've always been attractive to me. The most attractive thing is the way you light up when you speak about the grace of your higher power. I said, that really is exciting. Would you like to go to a movie with me? And so I said, drive your car. You don't know me. You don't need to need to ride with me, okay? Maybe stay the hell away from me. Maybe say no. Well, we went to the show. And we had a nice time. And we dated in groups. And we made sure that instead of going to listen to rock and roll, I went and listened to Christian, spiritual Christmas music and barbershop quartets and gospel bluegrass and just stuff that wasn't me. There was not going to be any Johnny Rotten or any of that. And it's interesting because, you know, I got to where I was doubting myself, and I said a prayer. God, help me to develop my talents. And there were so many things I thought I was good at for so many years that I really wasn't. And I went up feeling bad about that, like the coyote on Roadrunner. You know, I'm always smoldering in my life. I finally, there's only a few things that I'm good at. If I can offer there's a point in my life where not only going to literature studies every week, and I still do it. It's important I do that because now I open these books and they really mean spiritual things to me. And they're part of my life. And the word Bill uses is deportment. My entire deportment's changed, the way I present myself. You know, and I've learned from some smart people, keep my expectations beneath my gratitude. Keep the gratitude above my expectations. And that's what I try to do on a regular basis. Sometimes I still... I'm not perfect. We won't be walking on waters, and I won't be inviting you to ride my shoulders. But, you know, I've got a really good life these days, and I have a lot of freedom. And there's only one thing I have left to say, and that is this. And it's really a neat thing. It's a good topic for discussion. It's page 75 in the 12 and 12. And it is this. Step 7. Then in AA, we looked and listened. Everywhere we saw failure and misery transformed by humility into priceless assets. We heard story after story of how humility had brought strength out of weakness. In every case, pain had been the price of admission to a new life. But this admission price had purchased much more than we expected. It bought a measure of humility, which we soon discovered to be a healer of pain. We began to fear pain less and desire humility more than ever. During this process of learning more about humility, the most profound result of all was the change in our attitude toward God. And this was true whether we had been believers or unbelievers. We began to get over the idea that the higher power, higher power was a sort of bush league pinch hitter to be called upon only in an emergency. The notion that we would still live our own lives, God helping a little now and then, began to evaporate. Many of us who had thought ourselves religious awoke to the limitations of this attitude. Refusing to place God first, we had deprived ourselves of His help. But now the words, "Of myself I am nothing, the Father doeth the works," began to carry bright promise and meaning. We saw we needn't always be forced feeding of humble pie. We saw we needn't always be bludgeoned and beaten into humility. It could come quite as much from our voluntary reaching for it as could from unremitting suffering. A great turning point in our lives came when we sought humility as something we really wanted rather than as something we must have. That's a talisman. It marked the time when we could commence to see the full implication of step 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. So, you know, it's interesting. I don't have to make demands of God. I don't have to demand comfort from y'all anymore, you know. This program is loud to me that I'm the sum total of my efforts, and I got to stay busy because my disease is still busy. So I spoke a little bit long, and I made a little bit of sense, but thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Steve. It was a pleasure to hear those remarks. Actually, Tim, you're our pinch hitter emergency chip placer, because we forgot to ask anybody, but you're somebody.
Hey, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Steve. That was terrific. And I'll run through them one time. White chip, if you're coming in or coming back and you don't want to drink today, it's a day chip. Anybody need a white chip? Anybody need a white chip? All right. Silver chip for 30 days. Red chip for 90, or 60-day chip, gold. Red chip for 90 days. Yellow chip for 6 months. A green chip for 9 months. And a blue chip for 1 year or any multiples thereof. Anybody want a blue chip?
Yeah. All right.
I'm Ben. I'm powerless over alcohol.
Amen.
I've stayed sober for a year. Haven't had relapses. I'm working to get better. I don't always understand what's happening, but I'm trying to understand it. Thank you.
Anybody else got a birthday? Any reconsiderations on the white chip? Congratulations on the chip, your heart.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight.
It's the bottom.
self-doubt. It's the Bible, the book, or the girl.